3, 2, 1.
Hi, it's Shalana, and you are now listening to the Shalana Folks Talk Show, where mom entrepreneurs gather to discuss how we balance motherhood and entrepreneurship. I'm so glad you're here. Grab your coffee or whatever gets you going, and let's start the conversation.
3, 2, 1.
Here we go!
If you've found yourself in a place of desperation and devastation, you want more for your life and for your children, then this episode is for you. My guest today is Dr. Mary Kay Holmes, a number one international best-selling author, UN ambassador, motivational speaker, empowerment specialist, mentor coach, and New York City tax attorney. Dr. Holmes serves alongside her husband, Apostle Terry Holmes, as executive pastor and First Lady of Triumph Church of Waterbury, Connecticut. As a survivor of domestic abuse, molestation, rape, human trafficking, prostitution, incarceration, and multiple suicide attempts, through her podcast, Ready, Set, Grow, Dr. Holmes speaks from her heart concerning real-life issues that plague women all over the globe. Dr. Holmes has been endorsed by the likes of Valerie Jarrett, who is the former senior advisor to President Barack Obama, Connecticut State Senator Marilyn Moore, R&B star Lil Mo, Real Housewives of Atlanta star Kenya Moore, and brand strategist Dr. Tiana Von Johnson. Dr. Mary, thank you so much for being here. I'd love to go ahead and get started. My first question for you is, what was your childhood like? Like, what did 8-year-old Mary wants to be when she grew up?
8-year-old Mary. Now I got to think back to 8 years old. What grade is that?
Maybe like third grade.
Okay, great. So third grade, Mary just knew she was going to be a writer. Like, I remember I used to bug my sisters and brothers and my sister and my brother, and I would constantly read to them. They would get so annoyed because there's such a huge age gap between me and then the youngest older sibling. And so they were all older. And when they would bring their friends over, I would try to read to them. I would tell them, one day I'm going to write a book and you're not going to be in my book. And, you know, that's how I would get back at them, you know, as a kid. And so I just knew I was going to be a writer. I would write poems. It was actually around that time when I first had that spark of writing poetry and just writing little short stories. Mm-hmm. And I remember I was just so full of life and so energetic. But there was also, you know, some dark times. There was times when I would get teased a lot. This was third grade, was around the time that I had my first, you know, boyfriend, or what I thought was a boyfriend. Mm-hmm. So there was some dark times because I started to act out some of the things that had been done to me even earlier in my childhood. And so I began to behave in ways that just wasn't, normal for an 8-year-old or, you know, a third grader. And I got teased a lot by my siblings. And also it was around the time when my mother had just married. So unfortunately, what started out as a spark of a romance, it's, you know, soon fizzled out because he became a alcoholic and also a crack addict. So my childhood was filled with those two ends of the spectrum. You know, I was just budding and learning some of the things, the gifts and talents that I had, and I was just starting to develop that passion. And also I had these other life altering situations happening at the same time.
Okay. Now, where did you grow up? Because I know you had mentioned South Carolina and Connecticut. So how did that work?
Well, interestingly, this was around the same time that we just moved back to Connecticut. So third grade was where I started back into elementary school in Connecticut. But prior to that, I had grew up in the South in South Carolina. So for first and second grade, I was going to school in Saluda, South Carolina, which when people hear that, I have to tell them, like, look, it's not even on the map. Right. We grew up in the woods. I mean, down in the woods to the point where if you got sick or something happened, you broke a arm or something, you weren't going to the hospital. You had to go up the road to somebody's house that knew what to do. And, you know, that's the kind of, you know, upbringing I had, but I loved it. You know, we had farms, you know, one of my jobs was to take out the pig slop.
Oh, so wow. I was a part of the pig. Okay. So yeah.
It was fun.
Okay. Yeah. So then you kind of, you know, so once you got to Connecticut, like what was life like? Like what was your childhood like?
Well, once we got back to Connecticut, that's when things really started to shift. And like I said, I was developing into who I wanted to be, even at that early age. So one of the most like craziest memories that I had was when we moved into this, you know, six family apartment building. Now, you know, going from the South, living in the house with my grandparents, where, you know, we got all of this land, we got all of these woods, we got three houses on the land, my grandfather's shed, the main house, and then there was the old house is what we called it. So you got all of this land, and then we moved to the North where, you know, it's nothing but streets, chaos, not a tree in sight. Right. In this six family apartment building where we lived on the third floor, but the building was so dilapidated that my stepfather at the time, he was hired as the superintendent of the building to help fix it up. So when we moved in, it looked like a haunted house. I mean, the balcony had fallen off the front of the house. Thank God no one was injured. The garage was completely like torn down to where it was like a hazard to even play in the backyard. So I went from having that, you know, open playground, so to speak, with all this land at my grandparents' house to having this limited space in the front yard where you're pretty much like, you know, just this little patch of grass, you know? And so it was an interesting transition. So that no one's ever asked me about that. So it's like, even just funny, even like recalling how that shift happened and how I was able to adjust quickly from the country girl, the Southern Belle, into this city life. I had this thick country accent. Everything I said, people would mimic me and repeat what I was saying. They would say your name again, Mary Kay. And what's your birthday? October 13th. And I had this thick accent, and I worked so hard to get rid of it. And now I'm like, I wish I had kept that Southern accent because it's so adorable.
Okay, so, you know, I read a little bit about you, and you've written several books about your life. I don't know if you kept your brother in or out of the book after all, but you had like a lot of devastating moments, you know, from childhood up until, I guess, adulthood. You mentioned, you know, like molestation and like sex trafficking and even like just the abuse, period. Like, that's a lot for one person to go through. I'm like, wow, that's, you know, would you like to explain or share how that all started, like how you found yourself in those positions?
Yeah, absolutely. So like I mentioned, early in my childhood, there was childhood molestation, unfortunately. And it's unfortunate there's so many people, I'm sure, that as, you know, I'm even saying this, that's watching or listening, they can probably say, oh my goodness, like, you know, that happened to me too. It's hard for me to encounter someone who hasn't gone through that or doesn't know, or, you know, doesn't know someone who has gone through it, unfortunately. And so like many others, very early on in my childhood, and it continued in my early childhood years, continual molestation. So I was very sexually curious at a very young age. That's the most PG-13 way I can put it. And so as I began to grow up into my teenage years, I became sexually active very fast. Mm-hmm. So I lost my virginity at the age of 12, and I became pregnant at 14 years old. And so being 14 years old and pregnant, you can imagine, you know, there was so much going on with, you know, dealing with the backlash from family members being talked about. But also, you know, with my mom, you know, there was a fear, you know, once she found out, you know, she made me get an abortion. So that was a traumatic experience all on its mm-hmm. own. But when she first found out, that was that fear of what she would do, you know, how much trouble would I get into? And of course, you know, she was furious, but it also made me rebel even more. So sadly, by the time I was 15 years old, I was out there in the streets again, you know, partying, smoking weed, drinking, doing things that, you know, I can't even imagine. When I look at 14 and 15 year old kids today, I look at them and I'm like, they're babies. What was going through my mind to make me think I was old enough to do some of the things that I was doing? So for example, I would go out and I would party at these parties at 14, 15 years old until 2 o'clock in the morning, and shootings would take place almost every single weekend. I remember being in one party where a girl was shot in the head. Thank God she survived, but I wasn't that far away from her. I could have easily been killed at any one of these parties. And the amount of things that would go on, just I just was exposed to a lot. So by the time I was 15 years old, I was working. I had a, you know, job, and I was working at a Baskin Robbins and at Dunkin' Donuts. And this man began to come in every single day, and, you know, he would come visit me at my job. I'm 15 years old, and I didn't know how old he was, but he would come in flashing his jewelry. He would come in and buy something really small, but take out this big wad of cash. And he would come in with all these colorful t-shirts and his fitted hat. And, you know, I would just kind of, he would flirt with me every single time. And so one day he said to me out of the blue, how would you like to make more money in one day than you can make in an entire week at this job? And so, of course, I was curious. And as he continued to flirt with me and say these things, one day I just quit my job and just left and went with him to work with him. And this man turned out to be 36 years old. He knew how old I was. He would drop me off and pick me up from school, from high school, and take me school shopping and all of that stuff. And he wined and dined me to the point where I just completely just fell head over hills, but didn't know that I was being groomed. I didn't know that I was being slowly trapped. I didn't know that he was scoping me out and had been watching me for months. And I was the first of many young girls that he snatched up. And I wound up under his control, being manipulated, brainwashed, and eventually human trafficked. He had me transporting cocaine across state lines. He had me bringing cocaine in from New York. We would go into the Bronx, and we would sit down in a diner or some kind of, you know, little small, you know, indescript type diner, and people would slip drugs into my backpack, and it was my job to carry it back into Connecticut, because the unspoken rule was, you know, we get caught, you're taking the rap for everybody. And so he had me cooking up the coke, bagging it up into eight balls, weighing it out, and putting it into the streets of New Haven, Connecticut. And all of this, I'm just a teenager, still in high school, and it eventually became abusive. It became even more controlling. And to make a long story short, I wound up getting pregnant, and he wound up trapping me inside of his small one-bedroom apartment, going days without food, pregnant. And it really got so bad to the point where he would not let me leave the house. He forbid me to use the phone. He had it rigged. I'm going to date myself here, but he had the phone rigged so that the calls that came in would go straight to his pager. So I wasn't able to answer the phone, and I could not use the phone. And he had me so brainwashed and so intimidated, and I felt so threatened that even though the phone was right there day in and day out, I would not call anyone for help. I wouldn't call anyone to come get me. And even though I could have left out of the apartment at any time and just asked someone to call 911 for me or call my mother, I was that afraid that I stayed trapped in that small environment, that confined space. And the only way I was able to get out was I used the excuse of it's getting close to my due date. And I knew he didn't want to be concerned with the hassle of taking me to the hospital. I knew he wouldn't want to take me back and forth for the visit after my baby was born. And so I used that to my advantage and said, you know what, look, what if you take me to my mom's house so that you won't have to worry about taking me back and forth to the hospital, or when I go into labor, you know, you won't have to worry about rushing back home to take me to the hospital. And that's what got me out of that house. Sadly, I did wind up going back eventually, but that was how it started.
How old were you at that time when you were pregnant?
When I was pregnant, I was 17 when I got pregnant. He made sure he waited, because I got pregnant before that, and he made me have an abortion, and I know why. He did not want any proof or evidence that he was that he and I were being sexually, you know, involved under the age of 17. So I had to get past that age of consent before he would actually let me go through with the pregnancy. So when I got pregnant at 17, he let me keep that child. And so 17 going into 18 is when I got pregnant and then gave birth to my son.
Okay, so wow, that's a lot, because at 14, your mom made you get an abortion. Then I imagine you may have been like 15 or 16 when you had to get the second one.
When I got the second one, I had to be between 15 and 16 years old.
Mm-hmm. So how did you deal with that? I mean, at that, like, you were so young. I'm sure the second time around having to get that abortion, you're probably having flashbacks of your mom making you do it. Like, what was that like?
It was, oh my goodness. Like, going back to that time, it was so traumatizing for me because, you know, I was at this state. I was in this state where I wanted someone to love me. You know, I was at that state, and I know it's not a healthy situation to be in where you want to have a child because you're looking for someone to love you, or you're looking for something to replace something that's been lost, or, you know, you just need that, you know, that source of companionship, so to speak. But that's where I was, you know, especially being such a young girl, being a child myself. I thought that, you know, look, what happened, at least I will, you know, have a child who I can love, someone that'll love me, it'll be unconditional, all of the above. And then to have that snatched away from me, it was like a twofold traumatic experience. And so just thinking back to my mindset back then, you know, I was very damaged, I was broken. And it was like, I didn't have time to heal before something else would get just, you know, thrown on me, or something else would happen. So it was like, I just didn't have time to recover. And so, you know, during that time, you know, when I had the second abortion, I remember thinking, you know, I hope I'm not damaging my body. I'm hoping that, you know, one day when I'm ready to have children, that, you know, my body is not so badly damaged that, you know, I would, you know, have any issues when that time came. And, you know, it's all of these fears were going through my mind, you know, and I think with the second abortion, it wasn't as a traumatic experience surgically, so to speak, or medically. It wasn't as invasive because it was the abortion by pill. But, you know, still just it's like you're having a miscarriage when you do it that way. So it's almost like it's not that one day and then it's over. But I had to go through this process of seeing my body go through these changes. And it was very scary, just to be completely honest.
Did your mom explain to you why she wanted you to have one? I mean, was it just the age, or was it like, was she in the church and she didn't want, you know, people? Like, what was her reasoning behind it?
There was that was part of it. The church, being in church, and you know, there was this whole, you know, shame behind it where she didn't want anyone to know. But at the same time, like a lot of our moms, you know, growing up, you know, sometimes it's like you know, you could see that your parents might not like the things that you do. But she got on the phone and told all my aunts and all my cousins. And I can laugh about it now, but I remember thinking back then, you know, like how could you do this? But it was part of my punishment. And I heard her on the phone and she said something that never really fully went away as a child and into my early adulthood years. She said, "You're no better than anybody else." And she wanted people to know, she wanted me to know, just like my other cousins or other people in our family had messed up or weren't doing all the right things. Because I was this honor roll student, you know, I was always praised for how smart I was. And, you know, I was the shy, quiet one. So I wasn't into as much as some of my other relatives. Mm-hmm. So it was like, this was the time that everybody, I could be put on display and say, see, she's not perfect. And so that was something that really hurt back then too. But part of my mother's reason was the church, I think. And I can't say for certain, but I think that was. And I think the other part was that I was just too young. And she saw that, look, 14 years old, I'm going to be the one taking care of this baby. And I believe she just wanted, she saw the potential in me. And she thought that, I think she thought that she was sparing me years of setback. And she was hoping that I would move forward and not let anything else get in my way of some of the things that she saw I was destined for in my future.
So now you say she saw like your potential, but why do you think, you know, through her seeing your potential, why would she want to prove that you weren't perfect? Did she have you young? Was there like some type of jealousy, or why does she want to have to feel, why does she feel like she had to prove to other people that you weren't perfect?
Yeah. See, I don't think it was jealousy. And I say that because my mother, she was the, you know, she was real Southern. Like I was a little Southern belle, but she was Southern.
Not for real. Okay.
And I think it was just one of those things in our family that had just been passed down and still exists to this day. That's something that just seems like it's unfortunately still a common thread with a lot of my relatives, a lot, especially the older relatives. It's this attitude. It's just this openness that they have with each other that oftentimes comes to the detriment of the children, where they'll just gossip about, okay. It just comes natural. They'll just gossip about the kids. That was just one of those things. But I think that line, I think that when she said it in the process of just telling her sisters, you know, my aunts about what I had done, I think it was also that need to fit in, not so much fit in. I can't really say that for sure, because there was always these differences between my mother and her kids and my aunt and their children. So I can't say for certain what she was thinking about. You know, she passed away in 2007. And if she was here to this day, I could have an honest dialogue with her. That's the kind of relationship we had towards the end, where she would be open and honest with me about her whys and why she did this or why she did that. So I can only guess. But she wasn't the type of person that competed with her children. She was just that person that she had a lot of gifts, a lot of talents on her own. And she struggled to really just, you know, make the best life for us. And I was her last child. I was her baby. So okay. I was her pride and joy. So there was like this duality going on where on one hand, I was the cookie cutter, perfect child. So they thought up until a certain point. Mm-hmm. And so I was the one that was always put on this pedestal. And plus, I don't look like my siblings. I don't even look like my mom. And so, you know, I think that with her being, you know, being that I was the baby, you know, I was the baby of the family. I think in her, there was this conflict. And again, I can only guess, and I'm going by what I know about her. I think there was this conflict of, you know, here it is. I put her on this pedestal. She's my pride and joy. She's my baby. I was the one that got paraded around a lot, dressed up in all those fluffy dresses and with the hoop skirts and the big bows and all of in the fluffy the frilly socks, and then all of a sudden it's like Mary's not perfect anymore, and I think it hurt her. Well, I know she was hurt. I know that much, and so I don't think she knew how to process that shift from me being the perfect child. And then all of a sudden, well, she's the only one that's done something like this. Because I mean, my siblings, now they're not perfect either, but I was that rebellious child. It's like I gave my mother a run for her money, and I think it caught everybody off guard. Let me just leave it like that.
Okay. Do you think in some way maybe she felt guilty about you not being the perfect child? I know you said that you dealt with molestation and that caused you to become more interested in sex and to kind of like rebel. Do you think there was something in her that said, I let this happen? Or I'm not sure who your abuser was. It was, you know, if it was someone that was close to her or someone in your family, because usually they say it's someone you know. But if you wanted to share, then, you know, go ahead.
Yeah, she didn't know. No one knew. Actually, no one in my family knew, except, of course, the molester, who is a family member, older male family member. And no one knew until I wrote my first memoir, until I wrote Stripped, which was 2018, I believe, when I released it. No one had a clue that I had been molested. Now, the interesting part of that is I held it in for all of those years, even though it's this open secret who the molesters are in our family. Everyone knows it. We know it goes on. We've known it's been going on. It's not something that we recently discovered. I mean, this is something that had been going on for so long in our family that it goes even far, many years before I was even born. It was just this thing. And I remember asking my mom, I said, why do we have so many child molesters in our family? Because no one had ever been arrested. No one had ever gotten into trouble. No one had ever been exposed. And when we would have Thanksgivings and gatherings and family reunions, these people were sitting right at the table with us, and everybody would know who they were. And so for me, I would ask my mom, like, I remember having this one conversation with my mom where I asked her, why don't we call the police? And and I remember her words so clearly, like it was yesterday. And it shocked me, because one of the molesters that I was speaking of had recently molested a very young cousin of mine who was still in diapers. And everyone was talking about it. Everyone was furious, but no one called the police. And I said to my mother, I said, why don't we call the police? Why don't you call the police? And she said, I'm not going to call the police and have my sister mad at me, because it was her sister's son. And at the time, I'm young and I'm not fully processing it. But years later, I realized, like, wait a minute, you value what your sister thinks about you over the safety of this child, who at the time was like 2 or 3 years old. I don't remember exactly how old she was, but she was like, she was a baby.
Yeah.
And she, and I'm not going to go into the details of how she was molested, but let me just say this, it was brutal. And I could not wrap my head around it as a young girl, why no one had called the police.
Mm, that's heavy. Oof.
Yeah.
Okay. So that was a lot. So now when you were living with this man who, you know, was the human trafficker or whatever, did your mom wonder, like, were they looking for you? Like, where's Mary at? Did they?
That's a good question, because at the time, they knew that I was still in Connecticut, but they didn't know where I was.
Okay.
They knew that I was with this person. Now, they didn't know how old he was.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things that he was very careful to do was to hide his age from both me and anyone else that knew me. Mm-hmm. And so when my mother knew that I was being taken out to dinner and taken to the movies and all of that, she said, you know, because she was a strict mother, she would say, look, I need to know who you're going out on these dates with. I need to meet this person, because you're not going to keep just running out the house every time I hear a horn blow and I never meet this person. So he hired somebody. He paid a young boy to pretend to be him. So the young boy used his car and brought me home one day, and then came in to meet my mother. And so that way, every single time she saw that car pull up, she thought it was the same young man who was my age taking me out. So no one knew what he looked like.
Oh, wow.
But they knew who I was. They knew I was dating this person, as far as my family is concerned. Now, my friends, they knew him. They would see him out and about, because he would hustle and he would be in the streets. And so they knew who he was, but no one knew how old he was. And so they knew him, but no one knew where he lived. And so when he had me in the apartment, it was about an hour and some change away from my family and my friends. And so years later, matter of fact, recently, about 2 or 3 months ago, I put a post on Facebook, you know, just kind of sharing a little snippet of my story. And one of my girlfriends, who I was friends with back then, but we had lost touch over the years, but reconnected through Facebook, mm-hmm. she commented on a post and she said, I remember those days. She said, I remember I ran into him and I asked him where you were, and he acted like he didn't know where you were. And she said, I always knew there was something about him. She said, because she tried to warn me about him early on, and we parted ways and we fell out because I didn't like that. I thought she was jealous,
yeah,
but she was like, I don't like this guy. And we wound up not really speaking much. And it just kind of, you know, dwindled down to the point where we just stopped speaking altogether, because I was spending so much time with him. And then when he got me out of my environment, away from my friends and my family and any support system that I had at the time, she said she ran into him, and he said, he didn't know where I was. And she said she always felt like she should have done more to help me. And I told her, I said, you did everything that you could, and I appreciate when you did try to warn me. And it just felt so good to have that person to know that there was someone out there that saw, you know, from the beginning. Unfortunately, I didn't listen, but at the same time, it felt good to know that somebody cared. They just didn't know where I was exactly. It was like that's why I call the book, the second memoir that I'm putting out now is called Trapped in Plain Sight, mm-hmm. because I was right there, but no one knew how to get to me.
Wow. Okay, so just going back a little bit, you said that you kind of got out by letting him know that, you know, he's getting closer to your due date and, you know, you're probably not going to want to take me or whatever, take me to my mom's house. First, did he let you go to, like, your monthly doctor visits?
Well, this is what I had to do because I knew my prenatal visits were so important. Mm-hmm. You know, I had the, you know, what to expect when you're expecting yeah. book. I had all the books from the library. And I had to take a cab. I remember because I was so far away from my family and I didn't have a license at the time. I didn't know how to drive. So what I had to do was when I could, I took a cab back and forth to the doctor. Now, this was leading up to before I was trapped in the apartment, though.
Okay.
Once I was trapped in the apartment, I couldn't even take a cab. Mm. So before I was trapped in the apartment, I was on campus at college. So for the first, the semester lasted probably about 4 months of my first semester of college. So I'm living on campus and I was able to get back and forth to my appointments by a cab. But then once that semester ended, for some reason, I was crazy enough to think that I'll be able to continue with my next semester pregnant, have my child go, you know, take a couple of weeks off, miss some classes, make them up, go back into school. But nope, I was unrealistic. So when that semester ended, that's how I wound up in his apartment. But nope, I did not go to any additional prenatal visits in that window of time. And then I went to my mom's house to have my son. And when that happened, then I was able to once again get back into taking cabs for the postnatal visits and to take my son for his pediatric visits. I had to develop a relationship, not a relationship, but develop a working relationship with a local cab driver to give me a special deal because I had to rely on him to take me back and forth to all these appointments. Like, you know, just thinking back on it, it's just ridiculous how, you know, you can, you know, have, you know, be a parent and you're not the only parent, but to think like the things that I had to do as a teenager, still a teenager and navigating, you know, parenting, but having to do it alone, mm-hmm. you know, it just blows my mind how many people have to go through that.
So when you finally stepped back foot into your mom's house, once he dropped you off, what was that like?
When I got back to my mom's house, it was like a breath of fresh air. Now, as strict as she used to be, I welcome going back into that house. I welcome going back into the strict environment with all the rules. I didn't care because if I thought it was strict before and what her rules were, it was nothing compared to being locked away in an apartment where you can't go anywhere, I remember being in that small, like one bedroom apartment, looking out the window, looking at other people outside, having fun, going back and forth, getting in and out of their cars, you know, doing just everyday life. And I had to watch it from this distance. And being back at my mom's, it was like, I can come and go as I please. I can walk out and get some fresh air when I want. It was like being released from prison and I had a whole new life. I can eat when I wanted to. I can eat what I wanted to. It was like, I remember when I was in his apartment, there was one time when there was no food for days and all I had was a can of tuna fish to eat. Mm-hmm. And I had to like literally like ration that off. Like, but being back in my mom's house meant I could get her home cooking again. I mean, where, you know, she would make we from the South. So, mm-hmm. I mean, I was in heaven. It was like getting out of prison. Like, that's the best way I can describe it.
But from your mom's point of view, like when you step back in the house, was she like, where have you been? Like, what's going on?
You know, my mother, she had this interesting way about her because, you know, as I grew older, it was like started to develop like a friendship, right? Okay. And you know, at this point, I'm 18 years old. And I think at this point when she sees that, all right, she's about to have a child, I need to start to let her grow up so I can't do everything for her. I saw this like shift in our relationship, and it felt good, where she was giving me more freedom. She still had the rules for her house, but at the same time, it was like she would talk to me more, and she would get a sense of, you know, what I wanted to do, and she would give me advice on parenting and leading up to me going into labor. You know, she would kind of let me know what to expect and, you know, put my fears at ease. And so she didn't ask me a lot about what happened, and I think that was because she just figured, let me move forward. She's making her own decisions. Let me not rehash anything. Let me give her freedom. She's made her decisions. She's living with the consequences of those decisions, whether good or bad. And, you know, I think that she, and again, I'm only speculating on what she might have been thinking, but just knowing my mom, I think she didn't ask me a lot about that time because it was like she wanted to give me my space. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, although her intentions might have been pure, if that was the case, I think it would have opened up a lot and would have allowed me to escape a lot sooner had I opened up to her about the reality of what's going on. And I know from my perspective, I didn't just voluntarily tell her what was going on because I was ashamed. Mm-hmm. Because now prior to that, people had been telling me, like my friend Danielle, that had warned me about him. My mother, who had thought she met him, when, you know, the person that she met thought it was him because he set it up that way. Although she met the wrong person, she still had her reservations. And so she tried to warn me, and she saw certain elements of control, and she saw the fear that I had, like if he would call and the way I would jump and run out the house, or, you know, if he showed up, I wouldn't let him wait too long. Or if, you know, she was very wise and very discerning. Like she had an eye to, you know, she could see things. And so I knew that she knew that it was an unhealthy relationship. So she tried to warn me early on. So my thought was like, I want to prove everybody wrong. Like, I want to prove, I don't want to go back and tell them I failed. I don't want to go back and tell them, oh, it was worse than what they even thought it was. So I didn't say a word. And she didn't ask. And so we just kind of moved forward, and we let me having my son and all of that kind of overshadow everything else. That became the center of our relationship, like her helping me with my child and navigating being a new mom. That just became the whole dynamic of our relationship for the most part.
Right. Okay. So you said you ended up going back to him. Did you have your second child with him as well?
I did.
Okay. And did he, I would imagine that he decided like he didn't want to be in their lives, or?
He did. You know, it wasn't that he didn't want to be in their lives. I think because once I turned 18, he could proudly display me and bring me around his friends and his family. In a way that he didn't do at first, because he wanted to hide the fact that he was with such a young girl. So now that I'm 18 years old and he has this child, now I'm like a badge of honor. Now I'm like that trophy girlfriend, mm-hmm. where he wanted to go around people that knew how old he was, like looking back, like I know what he was doing. He paraded around our son like a trophy, like, oh, I still got it. I got this young girl pregnant. She's pretty. She's smart. And I was able to bag her. So his idea of being in their lives, or, you know, at the time in our oldest son's life, was, you know, really just showing him off, making sure he had the best clothes, which for the most part, you know, he would give me money to go shopping. He was like a dad, in front, like when it was convenient for him, that's the best way I can put it. Yeah. When he could use it to his advantage. Mm-hmm. So when he could parade us around and, you know, our son has on all the Nautica gear or the Tommy Hilfiger clothes, and, you know, I got on my, you know, nice outfit, you know, and we, you know, he's driving us around, showing us off, it was to his advantage. But then when he would drop us off home and he would go out and do whatever he was doing, which was a lot, you know, we were stuck in the house once again. So it was like, now me and my son are back in a trapped environment where I wasn't able to come and go as I please, but now I have my son with me. So it made the days a lot easier, to cope with, because I had my focus was now on taking care of my son.
So is he the one who got you involved in prostitution? Was he pimping you out?
No. Okay. Now, when I escaped this relationship, because a relationship lasted 7 years. It was very abusive, very controlling. And so I was very broken and I was very vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And so when I escaped that relationship, I ran right into the arms of someone who took advantage of that vulnerability. Okay. And took advantage of that weakness that I had, and took advantage of the fact that I had not healed yet. And so he pounced on that. Like I said it recently, predators will be able to sniff you out a mile away. They know who they can shape and mold. They know who they can take advantage of. They know their victims. And so this person, this second relationship, he wound up taking advantage of that vulnerability and pretty much trapped me into this mindset where I constantly owed him a debt. Like, you know, at first he showered me with gifts and did all of these nice things for me, taking me to these spas and expensive restaurants and showing me all of these expensive, this expensive lifestyle, basically. And then one day he said, "You owe me." And when he said, "You owe me," I'm thinking, okay, look, maybe he's talking about, you know, giving him some or, you know, whatever, you know, like, okay, look, if I got to pay you back by doing this and that, you know, that's one thing. But no, he had a whole other plan in mind. He got me this, a burner, which is a cell phone where, you know, you can like talk and toss it away. Mm-hmm. And so he got me this cell phone, said, "Look, I want you to," I remember the day, like it was yesterday. It was like, he sat me down, and gave me all of these rules, and I didn't know where he was going with it at first. And then he eventually started to lay out this whole plan of how I was going to make money, how I was going to do all of this stuff and, you know, work it, use it to my advantage. But what he ended up doing was, guilting me into making me feel as if I owed him something. Mm-hmm. And when he did that, and he did it through intimidation as well, and did it through controlling and brainwashing, he wound up convincing me that this was the only way that I was going to be able to repay that debt, and to be able to do something for him, so to speak. And he made me think that this was like my way out of poverty. Oh, you're going to have all of this and that. You're going to drive this kind of car. You're going to live this kind of way. And he flashed this, you know, he flashed all of this money and lifestyle in front of me to make me feel as if, look, if you want this, this is what you're going to have to do. And that's how that started. And how it continued was through intimidation and control. And eventually that transitioned into dancing. And there's a lot that even goes into that. I don't think I've even talked much about, you know, that life and, you know, the amount of abuse and the things that I experienced in the clubs. That's a whole nother traumatic experience in and of itself. And my heart goes out to the women who are not doing this by choice, who feel trapped in that lifestyle, or that are taken advantage of by club managers or club owners, because there's a lot of things that they make you do, or make you feel as if you have to keep doing in order to compete in that environment. It's a very dark place. It truly is. And I remember having to go through that completely sober, because one of his rules was, you know, you can't drink. Can't be drunk, because, you know, if you got drunk, you know, someone could rob you, someone could take your money, or somebody could rape you, or whatever the case might be. You know, you're not going to be able to drive yourself home or whatever. So I couldn't, even while I was dancing or when I was out there, I wasn't allowed to drink alcohol. So it wasn't like I had the ability to numb myself. So right. I'm like fully aware of everything. And it was one of the darkest times in my life. That's the best way I can describe it, because it's like I remember being in this fog. It was like I had to shut my mind off, and I had to step into this persona. I had to step into this whole other like person, like a dark Sasha Fierce, so to speak. You know, like when I stepped out there into that life, I had to become this whole other person in order to be able to cope and do the things that I was being told to do.
So at that time, how old were your kids?
I am so bad with ages, to be honest. I'm bad with my own age. The only reason I know my age now is because I'm going to be 40 this year. But prior to that, I would have to ask my husband, like, how old am I again? I honestly don't remember how old my children were at the time. But I do know that my youngest son, he wasn't in elementary school yet. So he hadn't started kindergarten yet. And my oldest son was in elementary school.
Okay. I was asking because I was wondering how, you know, were they living in that environment at the time with you, with the, you know, the man who had you dancing and everything?
They weren't, they were in the house. They were with me at the time, but I would have my cousins or my niece babysit for me.
Okay.
So, and if they watch this, they'll probably be like, oh, that's why she would, because I would have them come over to my house and they would stay the night. And when I would meet up with this person, we would meet up in hotels to meet before I would go out and dance or, you know, I have like what we would call my clients. You know, he has certain rules for me. There was terminology that I had to use. Mm-hmm. There were certain races that I couldn't. Let me just make it plain. The rule was no black men, no Hispanic men, all white men. And
what? So, yeah. I thought you were saying no white men.
Nope, the rule was no black.
Was he black himself?
He was, yeah.
Okay, so he didn't want to be any other black men.
Yeah, so I don't know all his reasons behind that, but all I know is I did whatever he said. And so that was the rule. So I had to go out to these places that were like far away from where I lived. And so during those times, my cousins or my niece would come over and stay with the children overnight. And then I would come back the next day. And, you know, then they would be able to go home or I would bring them home. So I kind of shielded my children from it. And my family, they didn't know what I was doing. I told them I was bartending.
Okay.
So that explained the nightly schedule. So mm-hmm.
Did he make you bring the money to him to keep, or did he allow you to have your money?
Nope, I had to hand over all of that money to him. And that's why I often tell people, you know, when you, there's a lot of sex workers and all of that stuff, and they do it by choice. There's some people where this is their way of life, this is their livelihood. Yeah. But then there are another type of group of people who are being forced into this lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And even when it seems as if the woman's consenting to it, say like the whole pimp hoe game, just to put it plainly, you know, it's been glamorized and glorified. It's been, you know, commercialized and normalized. And a lot of times we forget that. Why do we think there's a such thing as the pimp smack? Why do we think there's a such thing as, you know, the whole term pimp up, hoe down? Why do we think there's even such a term as the pimp game? Like, it's a game because they toy with women's minds, and it's a manipulation game. And when women are brainwashed and they're unstable mentally, you can tell partially, in part, because no woman in their right mind, I want to make that plain, no woman in their right mind would put their life at risk, give up their body to sell, get all of this money handed over to them, put in their hand. And then because of the fear that is put in them, they take that money and hand it all over to a pimp. Why would any woman in their right mind do that? That really just speaks volumes to me about the instability and the ability for people to take advantage of women in that mind state. Because I remember having rolls and rolls of money, because when I would come from the club, I would have the stacks would be so big. I had them just wrapped up in rubber bands, and I would have to take all of that and then hand it over to this man. And I remember always feeling so cheapened. I remember, and the way he would manipulate it is he would tell me, I'm building us something. I'm building our empire. I'm building our way. Like, one day you're going to reap the benefits of this. I'm holding on to this because I'm doing something with it. I'm going to invest this. I'm going to build our stable. So I was what is called in the pimp game, a bottom chick. And so as the bottom chick, it was my job to bring in all the money so that he can build this, what's called a stable. And so when he built the stable, which is basically a group of women who are all doing the same thing for him, selling their bodies for him, bringing him the money, he's supposed to give us this dream life, which never happened, obviously. But one thing I can tell you is this, like, look, I built my own dream life. When I got out of that, when I began to live my own life, and when I got free from that control and intimidation, and I began to find myself and I began to live for myself, look, I went from trying to chase money to money chasing me down. Like, now I'm in a position where, like, look, I have something to bring to the table. Yes, I'm happily married, and my husband has an excellent way of providing for us, you know, being a retired state trooper, New York State trooper, you know, having his pension from the military and all, or his retirement from the military and his pension from the state police, and also still doing, working as private protection security. I'm just so excited that now I don't have to sell my body. I don't have to be out in the streets, but I bring much to the table. And I came into the marriage driving a Mercedes from legit money. Yes. And so I'm just so grateful that that was able to turn around for me. But I remember, I can't forget about all the women who are still in that situation, yes, who are still wrapped up in this dream, who are still holding on to this hope, or holding on to this pretty much this manipulation and this control, because they're hoping that there's going to be some outcome at the end of the day that's going to make up for all the years of hurt and pain and all of the abuse and getting smacked around and beat up. Like, I can't tell you the amount of times he punched or choked or slapped me, or, you know, knocked me unconscious. And all of that fear and intimidation that's put in these women, I know there's so many women still out there going through it. So I feel it's a responsibility that, as someone who can see that there is a way out and you can be successful on your own, you can, you know, come out of that and be a lawyer. You can come out of that, be a doctor. You can come out of that, be a teacher. You can be an entrepreneur, educator, whatever it is that you want to do. You can come out of that and be anything that you desire to do for yourself. And look, when I make my money, my husband is very careful about saying, like, look, when I go to the nail salon, I take his card, even though I got my own income. He makes sure he still takes care of me. When I go to the grocery store and buy groceries, I take his card. And it feels good to be in the position I am now. But I know there's so many other women that are still wrapped up, tied up, trapped in, and caught up in that life. Because once you're in, it's really hard to get out.
Oh, wow. Okay. So that was the devastation part. And so now let's get to the elevation, because you ended up becoming an attorney, you married a pastor, you're pastoring a church. Like, I'm sure you never imagined, you know, that you'd be a pastor's wife after all of that. Like, and so.
That's an understatement. Look. I wonder, like, who would want to marry someone with the type of past that I got, you know?
Yeah.
Who would want to marry a former dancer? Who, matter of fact, no, what pastor? What pastor would want a first lady that used to be a stripper? You know, what pastor would want a former prostitute as his wife? I thought about, you know, these things early on when we first got engaged. Now, prior to us getting engaged, I'm thinking I'm going to probably be single for the rest of my life. I was preparing that nobody would want me with the level of baggage that I had. Mm-hmm. I was literally preparing myself to be single for the rest of my life. And I had gotten very comfortable in my little apartment, in the nice neighborhood, living, you know, in this nice, comfortable environment, running my nonprofit. I had my jewelry business at the time. I was selling jewelry. I had my Mercedes driving it. I'm good. Like, I'm thinking to myself, like, I'm free. I'm not going to subject myself to any more control and unnecessary, you know, anguish and anxiety. I'm just going to live it up and enjoy life. But listen, when we got together, I really started to wonder, like, wait a minute, this man knows that about my past. Is he really ready to have me as a wife? Is the church ready to accept a first lady who doesn't have the cookie cutter pass? Like, is his church, like, really ready for a raw, real woman to walk up in there, not wearing the first lady hats and the Kojic suits? Nothing against the Kojic suit. I love a good Kojic convention where you can see all the outfits and the dresses and the hats. I love it.
I know what you mean.
That's not me. Yeah. So I was like, wait a minute. Is the church ready for someone like me, you know, to be at the forefront? Like, you know, I can't just sit on the back pew. Like, I gotta be up front. And literally, when I first started to visit the church right before we got married, I would sit in the back because I'm like, look, I ain't ready for this. And I'm thinking, like, to myself, like, okay, I am not that, at the time, I wasn't that vocal about my past, but I had been open and honest with my husband.
Right.
And I knew he told me back then, he said, one day you're going to tell your testimony. And he said, when you do, I want you to tell it all. And so I'm thinking to myself, like, okay, wait a minute. He wants me to talk about this stuff. That means that one day somebody's going to know, wait, you preach and you used to be a prostitute? I didn't know how that was.
Prostitution to preaching.
Right. I didn't know how that was going to be received. So I had that fear. But when I started to open up, when the Lord began to use me and tell my story, every time I tell my story, I can't begin to describe the reactions that I get. That people come up to me, oh my goodness, I went through that too. Oh my, how did you get out of that? Oh, I'm going through this. And they open up and they say things like, I want to be able to share my story too, but I'm so afraid. How did you get the courage to do that? How do you get the courage to say it and not worry about the backlash from your family? And I've been able to coach and encourage so many women and men to open up and be transparent within reason, because some people are not ready to open up yet. But you know, as much as possible, I try to help people to heal through the telling of their testimonies, because I've learned how much freedom I receive, just by opening up my mouth and telling it all. Because now it's like, look, can't nobody come up to me and say, oh, I heard this or I heard that, right, or somebody said this or somebody said that. No, look, let me tell you the real story, because I can tell it a whole lot better than they can. Let me tell you what really happened, because I can give you all the gritty details, the stuff that they left out. Because so what they said ain't even half the story. So I have that freedom now.
Right.
Because now people that knew things about me, no one can hold anything over my head. And that's such a blessing.
Okay. So you've done quite a few books. I Hate Being Broke, The Art of Unlearning, that you're Stripped, A Journey from Rejection to Redemption, Outlive the Labels, 18 Powerful Stories of Truth and Determination. Wow. You've written lots of books. So when did you first know, like, I have to start writing these books, I have to write in my story? Like, at what point in your life did you know that you need to start sharing?
Yeah. And in addition to those books, I got Trapped coming out, Face of Trafficking, on the 29th. And then I got two other books that I released last year, Trailblazers Who Lead and Successfully Broken. I realized, like, I had to start writing these books. I had to start telling these stories, because the first question that you asked me really just solidifies it. I had to go back and remember that childhood dream of mine. I had to go back and realize something that was in me all along, something that the enemy tried to stamp out, that fire that tried to be put out, that silencing that happened through these abusive relationships. I had to start to develop my own voice, find my voice, and revisit that dream and say, look, this is something that's always been in you. This is a God-given gift. Make the most of it. Don't hold back. This is the time. I was in law school when I first wrote my memoir. I was so fearful, because I'm like, look, not only I got to worry about what the church think and what my family think, I got to worry about what the bar association might think. I got to worry about what my law school might think if I open up and start sharing this stuff. But I said to myself, if you don't do it now, you might never do it. If you don't step out and find your voice now, matter of fact, you need to start telling it before you graduate law school and hurry up and get a jump on it, because you don't know what kind of fear might creep in if you start working somewhere and then you want to share your story, but now you're afraid of what your employer. No, look, tell it now. Get the fear out of the way. And once you get it out there, it's like the toothpaste and toothpaste tube. Once you squeeze it out, it ain't going back in. So you might as well get it out now and get over these fears, because there's going to come a time where the fear is going to become too great and you might never get a chance to share your story. And so I just went ahead and did it. And with the encouragement of my husband, who kept telling me, tell it all, I was like, look, I got to have the confidence to do this. And you've always wanted to be a writer. You always said you were going to write books. Realize your dream. Get that goal done. And once I started writing, it was like the floodgates opened. So I'm like writing book after book after book. I wrote Trapped in Plain Sight, The Unfamiliar Face of Human Trafficking. I wrote it in less than a week.
Wow.
I was like, I got to get this out. And I got so many books on the way that it's just like mind blowing. That once I unlocked that passion and really revisited that gift that God had given me and that dream from my childhood, from third grade, from around the age of 8 years old, knowing this is something I always said I was going to do, and to finally do that. And at 39 now, having all of these books under my belt and having more on the way, it really is just a testament to how, like, look, what's in you is going to come out of you. And so it's still coming out.
Jeez. And I know you actually coach writers. So tell me about that.
Yeah. So I like to help people to share their story too, because look, once I found that freedom, I'm like, I want to rescue as many other people as I can. And I knew that one of my insecurities as a writer was really like trying to find out, okay, where do I start? How do I get this out? And I had someone when I did my first anthology project, my coach at that time, she helped me to really be able to tell my story, even though I considered myself a writer. I had written for so many publications over the years. I had even gotten a scholarship from USA Today back in my early college years, and I was offered an internship with the New York Times. So I was always writing, but I hadn't written my book yet, you know? So she helped me to tell my story. And when she helped me to piece it together and get that story out, I said, I got to pay it forward. I really want to do this. I got to find the time to help people to share and open up, because there's so much healing in it. So I knew that it would be a gift that kept on giving, so to speak. So I committed myself to being a book writing coach. And so that's one of the things that I do, where I help people to tell their stories. I walk them through that process, help them to outline their books. And also I provide anthology project opportunities for them as well, just like I did for that very first publication that I was a part of. So now Outlive the Labels is an anthology where I bring in co-authors where they can share their story. And through that project, I also give them group and one-on-one coaching as a part of that package.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. So I do want to back up and ask, how did you meet your husband? Because you said you were in a period of time where you were like, okay, I'm single, I'm making my own money, I'm running my two businesses, my nonprofit. So, like, how did that happen?
We met in the church. Now, okay. I was going to a church where he was a part of the same fellowship. Okay. Those that are listening, if you're churchy, you know exactly what I mean. You know, I was going to a church, and my bishop was over the organization. Okay. And so because he was over the organization, there were other churches that were a part of that organization. And my husband's church was one of them. And so even though we didn't know each other, it took years. But, you know, we actually wound up meeting through that. So we knew of each other for years before we actually ended up dating. So we would see each other, I mean, year in and year out, literally. And he'll tell you, he's the first to say it. I was not his type. He was not attracted to me. He would see me with my two boys, and I was not his type at all. But God knew what he was doing.
That's how it happens, because even like with my husband, I wasn't really his type either. And technically, I mean, he really wasn't my type, but it worked out. So I think that's how God does things. It's like opposites attract. So
right. We are complete opposites. I mean, talk about, you know, because we didn't even go into how I'm formally incarcerated, how I spent time in state prison, but, you know, being, you know, someone who had gotten into trouble with the law time and time again, I had a lot of bad habits back then, to marrying a retired New York State trooper. Like, he's law enforcement and I'm over here breaking the law, you know? So we were definitely like opposites attracting each other.
Wait, so, okay, go ahead and share that story too. How did you get locked up? I know, you know, you were dealing with the cocaine, all that stuff.
Yeah. Now, for me personally, I didn't really start getting into trouble until I got out of that abusive relationship, after I got out of the human trafficking, because I had developed and took on a lot of bad habits from him. He was a criminal by nature. I mean, so many different things. You name it, he was doing it. And so for me, I took on a lot of his negative ways. I took on a lot of his criminal mindset and all of that. So when I got out of that relationship, I was like a hustler. So for me personally, you know, I know I was broken. I know I was vulnerable. I know I had a lot of issues resulting from the relationship, but a lot of these bad decisions that I made during that time, it was my way of like escaping the reality of what was going on in my life. And it was like my coping mechanism, so to speak. It was my escape. That's how I was able to kind of forget about everything else. So I'm out here just doing my thing and just out there, just breaking the law, doing what I wanted to do. And eventually, you know, time and time, like quite a few times, it caught up with me. And when it did, I would still go back and keep doing the same things, because I honestly felt like, look, this temporary feeling of satisfaction, this temporary gain, or this temporary fulfillment that I'm feeling is worth it, because it's the only sense of joy or excitement that I have in life. But I thank God that I eventually landed in prison, because that's what stopped me. That's what brought me to a halt, so to speak, because I knew, okay, look, it's getting real now. Now I can't just keep going out here breaking the law. I'm going to have to, if I get in trouble again, I'm going to serve time again, and they're going to tack on what I didn't, the time that I wound up when I got released early, they're going to tack on that time. So it was like I was scared straight, just to kind of put it plainly. I was scared straight, and I thank God for that time, because it stopped me in my tracks, and I had to make a pivot. I knew I could not continue to live that life. I knew there were real life consequences. It wasn't just about having a record. This was prison, and I did not want to go back to prison. Listen, there were so many women in there. They would come and go, and they would be back in there like clockwork every year. I said, this will not be my story. This is the first and the last time I will be in this place. And absolutely, I will not be going back there again at all for any reason whatsoever.
So being incarcerated was kind of like your Jacob moment, where you had like your encounter with God and you were like, look. So how did you develop your relationship with God to, you know, how did you switch from that life and come to Christ?
Well, I was raised in church. You know, okay. My mother, you know, my grandmother, they kept us in church. I mean, church all week long. I mean, everything was church. That was our entire life growing up. And when I got to the point where I started to rebel in my early teenage years, all of those things that I was doing wrapped up in all of that was me rejecting the faith. I was a person who even dabbled in witchcraft. And when I say dabble, I think that's probably an understatement, because I had all of these books. I had tarot cards. I had crystals. I had all of the things that are becoming popular now and gaining this, you know, this trending and all of this stuff with crystals and being
so, an tarot cards are so like trendy now. I'm like, what's going on here, devil? Like, what are you trying to do?
It's the devil. But and it's worse now, because now you got the element of social media involved. And so when something's trending, people will hop on it without even knowing the depth of what they're diving into. And so for me back then, I had books. You know, it wasn't like I can just Google, because the internet wasn't even hot back then either. Yeah. You know, like this was back in the dial-up AOL days, you know, when you waited to get that CD in the mail with 200 or 500 hours of internet time, and the internet was like, you know, you went on and there was only like a few sites that was really good, like that you really wanted. I remember when Target first got online, like this is how long ago it was. But, you know, I had books. So I'm like, when you are in that mindset where you have to go and look for the information and really dig into it, you know you're serious about it. It's not like it was flashing up on my screen as I'm scrolling through social media. It wasn't like it was the talk of, you know, circles that I was in. I was actively going out learning this stuff. I'm learning that lifestyle. I'm learning what tarot cards are about. I'm using the crystals. I'm thinking about all of these different religions and philosophies, and I'm rejecting the faith that I was raised on. And I would literally tell my mother, how do you know Jesus wasn't just a man? How do you know he just wasn't a great preacher? How do you know he's God? There's so many other gods out here. How do you know your God is real? And I would try to convince people that Jesus was just a man. And I would just go into this whole spiel trying to convince people otherwise. Now, part of that, most of that came from the person that I had been with who was abusing me, because part of the abuse was that he forbid me to even go to church. I wasn't allowed to exercise my faith. So there was that level of abuse as well. I wasn't allowed to even pray with my children. So after years of going through that, I started to just reject the faith and started to take on some of that same mindset. Oh, I'm not going to raise my children in church. I want them to make their own decisions. I don't want them to feel like it's being forced upon them. And I, as a coping mechanism, I developed it as my own thought and my own way of life to make myself feel as if I was in control. But when I went to prison, it was God began to really deal with me concerning all of those things that I had done in the past, even though I was already saved when that happened. When I went into prison, I was already saved. But I had only been back in church really seriously and had really devoted my life to Christ seriously for like the past few years. But what really, I think, just to kind of answer your question more precisely, what really got me back into the church and developed that, like, that personal relationship with Christ was when my mother passed away and my best friend's younger sister was killed in a car accident. Oh, wow. That happened about a week of each other. Within a week of each other, we lost the both of them. Mm. Now, when my best friend's little sister died, and she died before my mom, I remember watching her and how on fire she was about Jesus and how she was someone who was admired for her faith. Mm-hmm. And I remember looking at her singing on the praise team. And I remember thinking like, wow, you know, she is just all in and she's so excited about believing in God. And she seems so free. And I remember desiring that and saying like, wow, like if she can do that, like what, and she's a teenager because she was 18. I'm like, what's stopping me? And something in me begins to like just have this spark. And so I went out and I bought a Bible. I went and got some gospel CDs because I didn't know any gospel songs. Now, I didn't know any of the gospel artists. To this day, you name people sometimes, I still don't really know them because I, even though I was raised in church, I spent so many years rejecting it that I'm still in the John P. Key, Kirk Franklin days. Yeah. I'm still in the, Reverend, James Cleveland days, right? Uh-huh. I'm in the gospel keynotes days, right? So when other people like Ernest Pugh and Marvin said, I didn't know these people. I didn't know. And so I'm thinking, I'm going to church and I'm looking at people like, how do they know all of these songs? How do they know all the lyrics? Like, how do they remember all of this stuff? How are they repeating? Like when the preacher would quote scripture and people in the crowd would recite the rest of the scripture, I'm looking around like, whoa, like, how do y'all know this stuff? Like, I'm the only one that don't know the Bible. So I bought a Bible and I started, I remember I used to go around telling people, my favorite book is the book of David. Now, I didn't put two and two together because I kept trying to talk about the books where I was reading about the life of King David. Yeah. In my mind, as I'm telling it, I'm the book of David. Look, I am lost. But I got the gospel CDs. I would play them in the car. I started learning the songs. And when I would go to church, now this is in a small window of time. You know, I'm seeing the fire that my best friend's little sister has. I'm getting a Bible. I'm getting these CDs. I'm listening to music and I'm trying to go to church. But I'm feeling very uncomfortable and feeling like I'm the outsider in the church. I'm feeling like I'm the only sinner in the group. I'm feeling like when the preacher's preaching, I'm the one that they're like pretty much like that. I'm the one that's standing out like a sore thumb and they feel like they got to preach the sinner's message because I walked into the church and they got to make sure I get saved. That I felt like I was the only one not saved and sinning, right? And so I felt like an outsider. But then unfortunately, my best friend's little sister gets killed in a car accident. And something in me just, it was like it jolted me. And I realized, wow, I don't have as much time as I thought I did. I'm thinking, oh, when Jesus comes back, that's when it's going to be, I got to get it together for Jesus come back. That's the goal. Yeah, if I get it together for Jesus come back, I'm good. But then I realized, wait a minute, something can happen to me. What if I die and I don't have that relationship? What if something happens to me and it's too late? I need to get it together. And so something in me, it was like it just shook me. And then a week later, boom, my mom's gone. And I'm like, wait a minute. I really got to get it together. It wasn't expected. It wasn't like there was some long illness where we knew the day was coming, where, you know, the doctor had given her a few days. Nope. She got sick and boom, within a few days, she's gone. I'm like, a car accident could take me out of here. I can get sick and I got to get it together. I don't have time. And I was so grateful that my mother at least got to see me get my Bible. My mother got to see me listen. She got to see me transition and start to get excited about church. And I said to myself, I'm so grateful that she saw that before she passed, because to me, that was bigger than her seeing me walk across a graduation stage. She didn't get to see me graduate from college. She didn't get to see me graduate from law school. She didn't get to see me get married. She didn't get to see some of the other milestones in my life, but she got to see me saved. And for that, I am so grateful that she got to witness that before she left. But those two incidents, I knew I didn't have time to get it together. I had to get my life together, all the way together. And I, from that point forward, even though I struggled early on, and you know, I'm no one's perfect, obviously. And we all go through things where, you know, we all fall short. But that time period, I'm so grateful that I held on to that faith. And from that time forward, I never let go, even through the setbacks and the slip-ups and the different falls and all of that stuff and mistakes. I held on to my faith. And to this day, you know, I'm just grateful that the Lord would use someone like me to be able to share, you know, my story of faith, you know, how I came into it. But also, out of all the things that I've gone through, I could see where God didn't give up on me. He was always pulling on me. It's like, look, I might have tried to resist, but I'm so glad that he didn't let me go, that he kept pulling on me, because I know I could have been in a whole different mindset. But it was God that was choosing me, that had chose me, not just choosing me, but had chose me and was continually choosing me, which is so amazing. Because I think often back to when I was in the streets and caught up in the pimp game. You know, the whole pimp game is based on being chose. I could write a whole book about that, because I mean, I know the pimp lifestyle backwards and forwards, unfortunately. But one of the main things is about being chose. And one of my favorite songs back then, and just, you know, just kind of getting myself in the mindset of like, okay, look, you might as well enjoy this. So there were some days where I tried to put on this persona, like I said, and pretend as if, look, this is what it is. And one of my favorite songs back then was a song by Willie Hutch. Way back from the 70s or whatever. Willie Hutch had this song called I Choose You. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to sing it because I am one of those first ladies that cannot sing. but there was a song called I Choose You. And that was one of the pimp anthems. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I got in the church, one of my first gospel songs that I learned and heard was by Dietrich Haddon, where he sampled that same song and made it into a gospel song. And I was able to relate to that and say, no, God chose me. Like, he chose me. Like, even though he knew every mistake that I would make, even though he knew I would be the person out there convincing, trying to convince others not to believe in him, he still chose me. And but like that alone, I said, look, I'm in this for life. Can't nobody convince me to give up on, like, can't nobody convince me to believe in any other God. Like, this, I'm in this. But this is permanent. This is signed, sealed, delivered. I'm yours. Like, no one can convince me to not believe in the God that we serve.
Wow, you have such an awesome story. Like, wow. What would you tell a mother who finds herself desperate or just in a devastating situation? She wants to like get out of that situation. She knows there's more for her life. She wants to build a legacy for her kids. Like, what would you tell her?
I would tell, you know, a woman that really just wants more, and they're if they're in a situation where they feel as if that's impossible for me, or I can't see myself attaining that level of success or going beyond that, listen, we might have a limited mindset sometimes about who we are and what we can accomplish. You have to consciously, you have to intentionally and strategically override those thoughts every single day. Like, that's something I had to learn to do. You have to have that self-talk. You have to tell yourself, because the enemy will try to put in our minds, like, oh, you'll never be anything. Or maybe it's not that plain. Maybe it's something real subtle, like, you know, just settle for this. For example, there was a time when I'm thinking, like, ain't nobody going to hire you as a lawyer with your criminal background. You might as well just go to school and get your master's in social work and be a licensed therapist. That's safe. Yeah, that was the safe route, but that wasn't what I wanted to do. I would have never felt like a success because it wasn't what I set out to do. So for me, there would have always been something missing, something lacking. So I had to go after the dream that I knew I had, which was one, being a writer, and number two, wanting to be a lawyer. I was a paralegal at the time, but you know, I was starting to settle. I was like, look, maybe I need to have a plan B. So I would say to anybody who's looking to attain that next level, who wants to go further, that sees beyond where they are, keep seeing that. Keep having that goal and that dream before you. Don't let it go. Don't let anything sidetrack you or cause you to start to second guess what you are destined to do, because what you are put here to do, you are here to solve a problem. And if you don't follow after the thing that you have been put here to do, you are not only doing yourself a disservice, but you are leaving behind countless other individuals whose purpose and their destiny and their healing is locked up in your yes. So you have to go forward. So I want to encourage anybody who's having second guesses, who's second guessing themselves, or who's wondering whether they should follow after that dream or that goal. Maybe you have some lofty, maybe you have some high goal. Maybe you have something that you think is too big. Maybe it scares you. If it scares you, good. It should scare you. Whatever it is that you want to do, go after it with all your heart, because listen, I'm a living witness that when you get to where you have set out to go, it feels so good. The feeling is indescribable when you meet that goal, when you reach that place. But even when you reach that place, don't get stuck there either, because there's even greater. Every level, don't be afraid to go higher, because when you get to that next level, you're going to feel like a novice. You're going to feel like, oh, I'm not good at this, but you're starting from the ground level. So don't let that deter you either. Every level, every level, you're going to have to start somewhere. You're not going to be an expert at everything, but if it's something that you're destined to do, you will get there, but you got to start somewhere. So that's my advice to anybody that might be listening that wants to go after a goal or a dream or attain the next level that they might have in life.
Yeah. So you said something that made me think of one of my favorite quotes, which is, if your dreams don't scare you, they're not big enough.
Right.
They're a motto that you live by in your life, or a favorite quote that you have that you like to share?
Oh, I have a lot.
What's your motto for your life?
Oh my goodness. Let's see. That's a good question. I have to develop one. I gotta get one. I put one in my phone recently, actually. Let me see. I'll pull that one out, because I'll put notes in my phone, left and right. Here's one that I put in my phone.
Okay.
Actually, yesterday morning. Actually, there's three. I don't know if you want me to share all three, but the first one is this: a man is not who he thinks he is, but what he thinks he is.
That's good.
And then I put, you never lose until you quit.
That's good too. What's the other one?
And the last one is, I didn't come this far to come this far.
Yes, I've heard that one. And that one is one of my favorites too.
Yes.
Dr. Mary, thank you so much. You're just full of joy. I love you. I've only known you for a short period of time, like virtually, but I'm so glad we were able to meet. And I appreciate you coming on and just sharing your story. And how can everyone get in touch with you?
Yes. And thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate this. I really appreciate, you know, you just taking the time to talk to me. And I appreciate the friendship that is budding. I am just forever knitted to you and connected to you for life. So I just appreciate the connection. So thank you so much for having me today. So people can stay connected with me through social media. Hear Mary Speak. So you can find me on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. It's all the same. Hear Mary Speak. Or if you're on Facebook, you can just search Mary Kay Holmes. Now, for me personally, if you want to reach out to me to work with me, the best way is just send me a DM on Instagram. But if you're not on Instagram, check out my website, marykholmes.com. There is a contact form where you can reach out to me through that way, and it will shoot me an email for me to be able to reach back to you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
If you enjoyed this episode, please give it 5 stars and leave a review. And don't be selfish. Share it with a friend. You never know who needs to hear it. Thank you for tuning in to the Shalana Foles Talk Show. And never forget, you're doing your best, and your best is good enough.